An article in the New York Review of Books in the 90s, Vaclav Havel said, quote, "For long decades, the chief nightmare of the democratic world was communism. 3 years after the collapse of the communist rule in the former Soviet Empire," he said, "it would seem as though another nightmare has replaced it, post-communism." A few months later in the same journal, Joseph Brodsky had this response. "The magnitude of what took place in our parts of the world in over two-thirds of a century cannot be reduced to communism. Catchwords, on the whole, lose more than they retain, and in the case of tens of millions killed and lives of entire nations subverted, a catchword simply won't do. What you," he's addressing Vaclav Havel, "what you call communism was the breakdown of humanity, and not a political problem. It was a human problem, a problem of our species, and thus of a lingering nature. Neither as a writer nor, moreover, as a leader of a nation, should you use terminology that obscures the reality of human evil. Terminology, I should add, that was invented by evil precisely to obscure its own reality. Why don't we simply start by admitting that an extraordinary anthropological backslide has taken place in our century, regardless of who and what triggered it?" So we must think about this extraordinary anthropological backslide. Unfortunately, as Brodsky points out, we tend to look at the problem of evil in our time, in the 20th century and the 21st, of course. We look at these problems with intellectual and interpretive habits that we have inherited from the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment chose to exclude precisely the sensibilities that we need in order to understand what is happening to us, namely the religious ones. So when we see these events, we interpret them in terms of politics or economics or sociology or psychology, but we don't get to the heart of them. And I think Brodsky helps us when he says this is an anthropological backslide. It's been said that if cultural anthropologists could write, a lot of journalists would be out of work. Increasingly, you know, journalists, they used to be able to just tell us what's happening, and that was fine. But now, because what they tell us is so perplexing, we hire them to come back and to do overtime, sitting around in a circle on television, interpreting the news, because it's so perplexing to us. And I think we have to think about what's happening in our world anthropologically. In terms of evil, which is what Brodsky was concerned about, I think there is an incredible watershed that must be attended to. That is to say, there is evil perpetrated by those who remain largely blind to the moral catastrophes in which they are caught up. People, to use biblical terminology, who have eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear. People to whom Jesus spoke at the crucifixion and said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." There is that kind of evil. But then there is modern evil. That is to say, evil perpetrated by those whose eyes and ears have been to some degree opened, and who nevertheless terrifyingly begin behaving like Nietzschean supermen or superwomen, pressing on, driven by the logic of sacred violence, namely that the evil in the service of which they are acting can achieve spectacular climax, or might achieve spectacular climax, and that in its aftermath, its ashes might glow with a shimmering sacrality, precisely because of the blood and death with which it is drenched. The logic of the old sacred system, the system of sacred violence, on which conventional culture was founded, and to which conventional culture returns again and again in order to regenerate its social solidarities and its false forms of transcendence. It's this latter form of evil that must be addressed in our time, not the form of evil that we get caught up in and lose our minds and go crazy and wake up at some time down the road, or our descendants wake up and realize what we've done. But evil we perpetrate even though we're aware of what's happening. Macbeth is a figure that can be seen in this regard. He says, "All causes shall give way. I am in blood, stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er." He wills to go on even though he sees what it is. This is the terrifying fact of evil in our world. The human blind spot, the most invisible thing on the moral radar screen, is the event in which human beings vent their violence on one figure or one subculture and transform all of the sinfulness of that community into righteousness on the cheap, turning all of the madness and sinfulness of the society into some self-congratulatory seeming victory over evil, namely the expulsion or elimination of those who have become their scapegoats. This mechanism, René Girard shows us in an elaborate demonstration, is at the heart of conventional culture. And the reflexes that predispose us to that are very deep. They are social and psychological, and they're very deep in us. And when we are in crisis, these reflexes begin to move and draw us into their operations. Speaking anthropologically, the cross, and when I say the cross, I mean events structurally identical to the crucifixion, a unanimous community gathered around one on whom all their sinfulness, all their madness, all their panic and terror is blamed. Speaking anthropologically, the cross is where sin-ridden humanity always goes to rid itself of its sinfulness, turning its sinfulness into righteousness on the cheap, without anybody feeling the first pang of conscience. It's an incredibly amazing little mechanism for turning sinfulness into righteousness. Something happens at the cross which is decisive, and decisive for understanding the kind of evil that you and I must try to address in our time. And that is, at the cross, we see what one cannot see and still enjoy the social benefits of that mechanism. The mechanism is unanimity minus one. Tremendous amount of social solidarity with the elimination of one. By the way, this is a violence reduction mechanism. That is to say, when it works, it only takes one. When Caiaphas says, "It's better that one should die than that the whole nation should be destroyed," he would have gotten a Nobel Peace Prize for that, for the arithmetic, because it's very economical. If everybody believes in the guilt of the victim, there's a Jewish midrash which says, if everybody thinks he's guilty, he must be innocent. You see, because the Jews understood they understood as human beings how ornery we are. It's very hard to come by unanimity. And if we have it, it's very likely we got it in some fishy way. You see? If everybody thinks he's guilty, he must be innocent. This mechanism is at the heart of conventional culture. And our reflexes that predispose us to it are very much a part of us, psychologically and socially. At the cross, what do we get? At the moment of Jesus' death, in Luke's gospel, the centurion is the one who is the least likely to get it. Why? He's a Gentile, he's a pagan, he's a Roman sycophant, he's been saluting Rome all his life, he's never read Jeremiah, 2 Isaiah. What does he know? Nothing. You see? And it's the centurion, because Luke wants to show us that this is a universal phenomenon. You do not have to be Jewish to recognize it, the truth of it. It helps to have read Jeremiah and 2 Isaiah and the psalmist, but you don't have to have read them. All you have to do is be a card-carrying member of any culture, because all cultures are based on this mechanism. And what happens at the cross is that all of its markers are reversed. The centurion says, "Behold, this is an innocent man." An innocent man. He sees the one thing you cannot see and still enjoy the social benefits of the mechanism, the innocence of the victim, and therefore the madness of the mob. The next verse in Luke's gospel is, when all the crowds that had gathered for this spectacle — one has to understand that word gathering here, not just socially, but psychosocially, anthropologically — this is the gathering mechanism. When you and I have somebody or some historical adversary or some internal scapegoat that we can agree on hating at the same time, we bond together. It generates a consensus, you see. It's socially generative. So when all the crowds that had gathered in that sense for the spectacle saw what had happened, they threw their hats in the air, had a ticker tape parade, and went home singing the national anthem. That's not what it said. That's the way it's supposed to have ended, you see? But it says they turned around and went home beating their breast. This beating of the breast does not mean contrition, it means confusion. The event that was supposed to bring the culture together scattered it. Scattered it. That's the beginning of the end of conventional culture. It's the beginning of the end of conventional culture. It's the revelation of the truth of the mechanism that fallen humanity has used since the beginning of culture itself for generating and regenerating its social solidarities and its false transcendences. They heard the cock crow, you could say, to use that term generically. The cock crows us awake, and we realize, we come out of our sleep, we wake up with a moral hangover, and we say, look at what we have done. We see the truth about the victim. Now, that is the mechanism for generating, as I said, the false forms of transcendence, all the gods of this world. Nietzsche laments at the end of the 19th century, 2,000 years and no new gods. 2,000 years and no new gods. What that means for Nietzsche is that we have lost our power of regeneration, our tools for regeneration. And the fact that he recognizes it as a 2,000-year-old phenomenon is part of the genius of Nietzsche, of course. René Girard has shown us what the God-making equipment looks like. It's structurally identical to the crucifixion. So much so that 19th century anthropologists, when they found evidence of this all over the anthropological record, thought of Christianity as just another myth, because it was so structurally identical to all these other myths, dying and rising gods and all that, Dionysus, etc. What they didn't see is that all the markers are reversed. What myth never tells you is the victim is innocent and the mob is mad. You only get that in the Bible. You get it in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and you get it emphatically at the crucifixion. So the God-making mechanism, the sacred-making mechanism, the sacrifice, that is to say, to make sacred, the sacrifice that makes sacred, has been crippled by this revelation. The scapegoating mechanism begins to work less and less. As C.S. Lewis says, death begins to work backwards. That is to say, it begins to break down so that it, instead of the economy of the Caiaphas formula, so that one dies and there's a lot of peace, more and more people begin to die and less peace comes out of it. And we're no longer blind. At the climax of such sacrificial rituals, whether spontaneous or liturgically enhanced, at the climax, there is a kind of black hole. No awareness comes out of it. You're inside the mythological bubble, and you believe anything, anything that lends moral and religious legitimacy to what you're caught up in. There was a Serbian Orthodox priest, I mean no slur on Serbian Orthodox priests here, but who was quoted in the New York Times a few years ago, and he said, "You Western journalists don't understand anything. Tito was a Mason." The fact is, Tito outlawed the Masonic order. But anyway, he said, "Tito's a Mason, the Pope is a Mason, all the Catholic hierarchs are Masons, and get this, after Mahatma Gandhi died, Tito became head of the Masons." After Mahatma Gandhi died, Tito became head of the Masons. He just said it like that. And the only thing standing in the way of the Masons taking over the world is the Serbian army, etc. Well, you and I are capable of believing such stuff. If we get caught up in it, believe me, we'll believe that. Don't think we won't. If you think rationality will protect you, if you think rationality is a sufficient barrier to such nonsense, don't think it for a second. You see? Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. These are serious prayers. René Girard says, "If the modern mind fails to recognize the strongly functional nature of the scapegoat operation and all its sacrificial surrogates, the most basic phenomenon of human culture will remain misunderstood and unresolved." If we fail to recognize the strongly functional nature of the scapegoat operation, any idiot, if you're not caught up in it, if you're outside of it, you can see that the talk about Mahatma Gandhi and Tito is nonsense. But if you're inside it, you don't see it at all. You have eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear. But if you're outside of it, any idiot can see the moral problem involved. But what Girard says is that we are in a crisis precisely because that mechanism, which is such a heinous mechanism, had social efficacy for which we must account and for the lack of which we must make up morally and religiously. That is to say, as the gospel deconstructs the myths of sacred violence, you and I have to learn how to live in a world without it. And that's a challenge because it has provided order and peace, relative order and peace, at the price of its violence and mystification since the beginning of human culture. So Nietzsche laments the fact that for 2,000 years we have been unable to create new gods. He says we have to. He wants to go back to a world in which you can do that. And he knows that Christianity is the rock in the road that has to be eliminated in order to do that. Henri de Lubac, on the other hand, the great Catholic theologian, says one of the signs of a mature spirit is without doubt the renunciation of false forms of transcendence. One must reject the gods, all the gods. That is precisely what the disciples of Jesus taught us from the beginning. If they were taken for atheists, it is not because they were making the banal claim to have discovered another God, who would simply have been one among many, but because they proclaimed him who is totally different from the gods and who frees us from their tyranny. They denied everything that the men around them took for the divine, everything that man at every epoch tends to deify in order to adore himself and tyrannize over himself in and through his God. The gospel is the only twilight of the gods. The gospel is the only twilight of the gods. In his famous Der Spiegel interview, Martin Heidegger said, "Only a God can save us." Darkly echoing Nietzsche's concern. Howard Nemiroff, after the experience of World War II, wrote a poem entitled "To Clio, the Muse of History." Clio is the muse, one of the ancient ones who tells us history in a nice lullaby form. And having come back from the trenches, Nemiroff is in no mood for it. And he says, "Tell us no more enchantments, Clio. Murders become memories, and memories become the beautiful obligations, as with a dream interpreted by one still dreaming. The interpretation is but the next room of the dream." We have to hear the cock crow, and Howard Nemiroff heard the cock crow in World War II. Compare that, if you will, to Nietzsche. who says, "I was abruptly awakened from my dream. But this was so that I might be made aware that I was dreaming and that I needed to persist in my dream under the pain of perishing." There you have the problem. How to deal with the fact that I no longer have eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear, but I have in me this lust to repeat the deeds that are best repeated by people who have such eyes and such ears. What am I to do? Let's talk about, for a minute, the effect of the gospel on history, and I want to use Hamlet. I'm glad we've turned the corner now. We're using literature, which, by the way, I'm supposed to be talking about Girard. Girard begins with literature because, by and large, it's freer from the ideological nonsense than a lot of other things. People have to tell stories that are plausible and less likely that ideology is going to take them captive. And so one often wants to begin there. Hamlet has a motive for sacred violence. He has a sacred obligation, as you know, to avenge the death of his murdered father, the king, the old king. Now, this is a sacred obligation, so one has to read this, or one can read this play, as the story of a man who feels the imperative to perform sacred violence. And Hamlet is absolutely committed to that, but he can't do it. And he can't understand why he can't do it. He says, "Bloody, bawdy villain," talking about Claudius, the usurper king. "Bloody, bawdy villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain, oh, vengeance." And then he catches himself up. "Oh, what an ass am I. This is most brave that I, the son of a dead father, murdered, prompted to my revenge by heaven and hell, must like a whore unpack my heart with words." See, all he can do is talk about it, complain about it. He can't do it. "How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge." My dull revenge. The question, of course, is what has dulled his revenge? He wants to perform sacred violence, and he can't. "I do not know yet why I live to say this things to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me." He wills to do it, but he cannot do it. Let me present an interlude again with Friedrich Nietzsche, who speaks so much about will and the will to power. But in one place in the Gay Science, he says, "The thoughtless man thinks that the will is the only thing that operates, that willing is something simple, manifestly given, underived, and comprehensible in itself. He, the thoughtless man, is convinced that when he does anything, for example, when he delivers a blow, it is he who strikes, and he has struck because he has willed to strike. Of the mechanism of the event, and of the manifold subtle operations that must be performed in order that the blow may result, and likewise the incapacity of the will in itself to effect even the smallest part of these operations, he knows nothing. Volition is in fact such a cleverly practiced mechanical process that it almost escapes the observing eye." This is an incredible passage for explicating Nietzsche's understanding of the will to power and his appeal to Dionysus. The metaphor Nietzsche uses to illustrate his point illustrates it almost too well. It helps ensure that what almost escapes the observing eye will not altogether escape it. It is precisely this will to strike a blow with which Nietzsche is concerned, and with the mechanism that gives rise to that will. Make no mistake, the mechanism Nietzsche is talking about is not the autonomic nervous system. The manifold subtle operations of which he speaks are social operations. Everything, he says, is in the highest degree involuntary, but it takes place as in a tempest with a feeling of freedom, of absoluteness, of power, of divinity. He wants to fall into the power of the gods so that he can carry out the deed. And the deed for him is striking the blow, as it is for Hamlet in some way. And Hamlet cannot do it. Hamlet has a paralysis of the will. But he knows how to, or he thinks he does, and he's right, how to break that paralysis. He knows that if he has his will to murder mimetically inspired, if he can see a good example of it that will whet his enthusiasm for performing the deed, he might be able to do it. So he gets his friends, the players, to perform a particular scene in a drama. And the scene is the killing of the old Priam, the old king of Troy, by Pyrrhus, the son of Achilles. And the narrator narrates as the play is being performed, and it goes this way. It's the perfect analog, of course, for Hamlet's paralysis. "For lo," the narrator says, "for lo, his sword, which was declining on the milky head of Reverend Priam, seemed in the air to stick. And so as a painted tyrant, Pyrrhus stood, and like a neutral to his will and matter, did nothing." Perfect analog for Hamlet's paralysis. "But as we often see against some storm, a silence in the heavens, the rack stands still, the bold wind speechless, and the orb below as hush as death. Anon the dreadful thunder doth rend the region. So, after Pyrrhus's pause, aroused vengeance sets him new awork, and never did Cyclops' hammers fall on Mars' armor, forged for proof etern, with less remorse than Pyrrhus's bleeding sword now falls on Priam." You see, Hamlet didn't have a video game. He didn't have Hollywood movies. He had to do the best he could. He had the players enact it for him, and it whets his appetite to perform precisely that deed. It's the way of surcharging this paralysis of his. He still can't do it. Now the question is, why can't he do it? He never understands why he can't do it. But does Shakespeare? You bet. Ask yourself, where does he have a chance to do it? In the chapel. Here in this play, you have a clash between the old pagan imperative of sacred violence and the Christian imperative of forgiveness. The play ends on the spirit of forgiveness between Hamlet and Laertes, but we don't have time for that. But here we have a clash. Hamlet walks up behind Claudius. Claudius is confessing his sins. Hamlet, who never knows why he can't kill him, says, "I'm not going to kill him now, because if I kill him now, he's going straight to heaven. I want him to go straight to hell." So he doesn't kill him. But Shakespeare knows better. But he sets the scene exactly right. He doesn't catch Claudius out walking around the palace grounds. It's in the chapel. Shakespeare knows what he's doing. And that's revealed in two very amazing passages, at the beginning and at the end of the play. At the beginning of the play, Marcellus, coming in off the heath, having just seen the ghost of Hamlet's father. The ghost of Hamlet's father is the voice of the pagan imperative. It is your sacred duty, it is your sacred duty to avenge my death. You see, the cycle of revenge that just chews up humanity. It is your sacred duty. How many people today are hearing this voice in their ear? Marcellus comes in off the heath having seen that. And he says, it, the pronoun it now refers to the old Hamlet, the voice of the pagan imperative. So one has to understand what's being said here. It fated on the crowing of the cock. There's more, but just pause there for a second. What are the chances that William Shakespeare wrote that line unaware of the Christian implications? Zero. Zero. And if you think there might be a chance, I'll read the following line. It turns out it's Christmas Eve. Listen to this. It faded on the crowing of the cock. Some say that ever against that season comes wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated, the bird of dawning croweth all night long. And then they say, no spirit dare stir abroad. The nights are wholesome. Then no planet strikes, no fairy takes, nor witch has power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is the time. Here's the problem Hamlet has. The bird of dawning is crowing all night long. It's one thing to have the bird of dawning crow at dawn, which allows you to kill the son of a bitch and wake up with a moral hangover. But when the bird of dawning croweth all night long, you've got a problem. Do you see? It faded on the crowing of the cock. unless you think I made it up. At the end of the play, Claudius, now, you see, Laertes has exactly the same motive that Hamlet has. Hamlet stabs the curtain. Polonius, the old windbag, falls dead. That's Laertes' father. So Laertes' father has been murdered, and he knows who did it. It's exactly the same moral problem that Hamlet had. So Claudius, like Iago, you know, calls at Laertes in and says, Laertes, did you love your father? Oh, I love my father. Did you really love your father? I did love my father. Laertes, did you really love your father? Or is it all just talk? I love my father. He said. Well then, Laertes, what would you do to avenge your father's death? And Laertes says, I would cut his throat in the church. I would cut his throat in the church. I would serve the pagan imperative in the face of the Christian injunction against it. You see? This is the opening out into a world that sometime later Nietzsche will begin to theorize about. I would cut his throat in the church. He no longer has eyes that cannot see or ears that cannot hear, but he's beginning to move to, according to the drumbeat of the Nietzschean Superman, who simply does it anyway. René Girard says, it is impossible to call up the forces which weaken or destroy religion without simultaneously calling up those which restore it. They are the same forces. That sentiment is echoed again by de Lubac. As soon as man ceases to be in contact with the great mystical or religious forces, does he not inevitably come under the yoke of a harsher and blinder force which leads him to perdition? It is what Vico called the age of deliberate barbarism, and that is the age in which we live. The age of deliberate barbarism. When Nietzsche talks about the death of God, it's the murder of God he's actually talking about, and he says so. We have become his murderers, he says. Who will cleanse us of this blood, he said. What are the rituals that will allow us to wash away our sins? What expiations, Nietzsche says, what sacred charade shall we be forced to invent? What sacred charade shall we be forced to invent? I want to talk now about sacred charades. One can go back just for a second, perhaps, to Shakespeare again. Brutus talking about the killing of Caesar and whether or not to kill Mark Antony as well. He says, let us be sacrificers, but not butchers, Caius. Caesar must bleed, of course, but let's kill him boldly and not wrathfully. Let's carve him as a dish for the gods, not hew him as a carcass fit for hounds. And here's where the sacred charade comes in. And let our hearts, as subtle masters do, stir up their servants to an act of rage, and after seem to chide them. This shall make our purpose necessary and not envious, which so appearing to the common eyes, we shall be called perjurers and not murderer. It's a carefully enacted sacred charade. It's no longer eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear. It's no longer honest ignorance. It is now complicit. And this is the terrifying fact of violence in our time, that some of us look into it and are able to perpetuate it in any case. There are, of course, examples of attempts to give birth to other gods than the Christian God. But as de Lubac says, Christianity, the gospel, is the twilight of the gods. It simply cannot happen in a world that has at all fallen under the influence of the Christian gospels. A ludicrous example, which I will share with you, is the French Revolution, and there's some colorful language about it in H.G. Wells. And I realize H.G. Wells is not a respectable historian, but he's a clever writer, and his passages on the French Revolution are quite interesting in this regard. He says, first of all, the violence creates a cultural meltdown in which we are more likely than not to fall into these delusions. we're more likely to believe the intellectual equivalent of things like when Mahatma Gandhi died, Tito became head of the Masons, when we're caught up in madness. So the collapse into violence is a preliminary to the emerging of myths of sacred violence, which we find plausible. So you have to see first the violence. Wells writes, once the unleashing of the mob violence broke out in Paris, nothing could have better pleased the fierce heart of the Paris slums. The Revolutionary Tribunal went to work and a steady slaughtering began. The invention of the guillotine was opportune to this mood. The Queen was guillotined. Most of Robespierre's antagonists were guillotined. Atheists who had argued that there was no supreme being were guillotined. Danton was guillotined because he thought there was too much guillotine. Day by day, week by week, this infernal new machine chopped off heads and more heads and more. The reign of Robespierre lived, it seemed, on blood and needed more and more as an opium taker needs more and more opium. This is a terrifying comment right there. You can go right from that to 6 million Jews and see what happens when this mechanism is unleashed in a world where it cannot accomplish its goal. It just chews up victims at an unbelievably voracious rate. We invented the word genocide in 1944 because we had to. If it works, it's economical. And if it doesn't, it's apocalyptic eventually. Lady Astor asked Stalin, how long will you go on killing people? And he said, for as long as it takes. For as long as it takes. That's the Nietzschean Superman for you. Nevertheless, an English observer, here's a little glimpse of what ideology can do to you, what the ideological blinders can do to you. An English observer in Paris wrote the following in a letter back to England. Every faculty of the mind has been awakened. All was hope and joy and rapture. The corruption and iniquity of ages seemed to vanish like a dream. The unclouded heavens seemed once more to ring with an exulting chorus of peace on earth and goodwill to men. When Mahatma Gandhi died, Tito became head of the Masons, etc. You get caught up in that madness. But what I want to call your attention to is what Robespierre does. If it's going to end, it has to be sacralized. It's absolutely essential, if it's going to have any social consequences, that it be sacralized. We have to discover a new God. This has to be a God-making machine again. So Robespierre induced the convention to decree that France believed in a supreme being, and in June he celebrated the great festival, the festival of the supreme being. There was a procession which he headed, brilliantly arrayed, bearing a great bunch of flowers and wheat ears. Figures of inflammatory material, which represented atheism and vice, were solemnly burnt. So you have the effigy, the ritual effigy, solemnly burnt, and then by an ingenious mechanism, with some slight creakings, an incombustible statue of wisdom rose in their place. Nietzsche says, what kind of sacred charades are we going to have to invent in order to cover our tracks? With some slight creaking, H.G. Wells said, it's not going to work. Perhaps it's worth mentioning another instance of this, though it's a little bit far afield, but I mention it because this issue has not been mentioned here, and I think it should be. In a New York Times op-ed piece a few years ago, Naomi Wolf wrote this. It looks like a dark hour for those of us who are pro-choice, but with a radical shift in language and philosophy, we can turn this moment into a victory. Our rhetoric has long relied on euphemism. An abortion was simply a woman's choice, quote unquote. This approach was bound to cede the moral high ground to our opposition. When someone holds up a model of a six-month-old fetus and a pair of surgical scissors, we say choice and we lose. She says, what if we transformed our language to reflect the spiritual perceptions of most Americans? What if we called abortion what many believe it to be? One holds one's breath. But again, the postmodern spirit here, all we have to do is change the terminology. The sacred charade. One hopes, I say one holds one's breath. I think of those words from Edna St. Vincent Millay that Michael True shared with us yesterday. She said, "I shall die, but that is all I shall do for death. I am not on his payroll." Perhaps Naomi Wolf will say that. But she does not. She said, "What if we call abortion what many people believe it to be? A failure." With a shrug. "Whether that failure is a failure of technology or social support or education or male or female responsibility?" Question mark. "What if we, frankly," this passes for frankness, "acknowledged abortion as a necessary evil?" And then she goes on issues of value like abortion and assisted suicide, the old Marxist Freudian secular materialist left has run out of both ideas and authority. It hasn't always been clear at our conference that that is the case, but Naomi Wolf says so. The emerging religious left is where we must turn. The emerging religious left is where we must turn for new and better ideas. We should call on ministers, priests, and rabbis of the religious left to explain their support of abortion rights in light of what they understand to be God's will. This is, by the way, precisely the kind of equivocation that Nietzsche despised. It was consorting with the enemy. Nietzsche said, "Look, choose Dionysus and get over it." There's a kind of honesty in Nietzsche. Even though he himself calls for sacred charades, and we have played them on every front, there nevertheless is a kind of honesty in Nietzsche. Girard says, "Our military men love to use mythological names for their nuclear missiles, Pluto, Poseidon, Ariadne, and the like. Too bad they never resorted to Dionysus himself. But it really does not matter. Those who understand do not need such literalness, and it would not make any impression on those who do not understand. The contemporary use of mythology is more profound than all the mythological games our philosophers have played since the Renaissance." 2,000 years and no new gods. No successful events of sacred violence that really left true transcendence or seemingly true transcendence in their wake. I have some remarks about the death of the nation state. Nicholas Boyle says that world history is the history of state-forming varieties of religious awareness. That's a very interesting thing. The primary sacrificial mechanism in the Western world in the last couple of centuries or more has been the nation state. If you want to identify a sacrificial regime, it is always the regime which allows you to kill with moral impunity and to die as a hero. These mechanisms, these structures that allow us to kill with moral impunity are the sacrificial systems. And the nation state has been ours for the last while. The nation state is passing into obsolescence, as Boyle says. And he says the various forms of nationalism, from harmless Euroscepticism to genocidal Pan-Serbianism, are cultural myths that keep this disagreeable truth at bay. The nation state is passing from the scene. Why is it passing? A couple of years ago, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I want to read to you from Michael Ignatieff's reflections on that appeared in the New York Times. 50 years after its proclamation, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has become the sacred text of what Elie Wiesel calls the worldwide secular religion. UN Secretary Kofi Annan has called the Declaration the yardstick by which we measure human progress. Now, what is human rights? It's the recognition of the truth of the victim. The recognition of the truth of the victim. Where does it come from? That's what Ignatieff is trying to track on. Human rights has become the major article of faith of a secular culture that fears that it believes in nothing else. The military campaign in Kosovo depends for its, this is was happening at the time, depends for its legitimacy on what 50 years of rights has done to our moral instincts, weakening the presumption in favor of state sovereignty. State sovereignty is another word for sacrality. That means to say that what happens inside the borders of that state are not the business of anybody outside of it. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights says the plight of the victims trumps sovereignty. In other words, sacrality, which is another name for sovereignty, falls in the face of the cry of the victim. This is the collapse of the old sacred system, our modern form of the old sacred system. Ignatieff says the long-term historical significance of the rights revolution in the last 50 years is that it has begun to erode the sanctity of state sovereignty, to desacralize the state. And then he goes on to say, Article 1 of the Universal Declaration enunciates rights. It doesn't explain why people have them. A cloak of silence was thrown over the question of God. This secularism has become the lingua franca of the global human rights movement, as English is the lingua franca of the global economy. Both serve as lowest common denominators, enabling people to pretend they share more than they actually do. Pragmatic silence on the ultimate questions made it easier for the world's very different cultures to sign up. For example, he says, a Soviet leadership desperate to secure Western acquiescence in the Yalta Conference conceded the right of Eastern Europeans to have human rights organizations without realizing that this opened the door for rights movements which eventually brought the Soviet system crashing down. If you recognize the truth about the victim, the sacrificial mechanism which depends on the misrecognition of that truth collapses. Now, he says, in this 50th year, a lot of effort has been expended in proving that the moral foundations of the Universal Declaration are derived from the tenets of all the world's major religions. Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer has described it as the essential document, the touchstone, the creed of humanity that sums up all creeds. Ignatieff then says, this religious syncretism is innocuous enough as historical and inspirational rhetoric. But as Paul Gordon Loren, author of The Evolution of International Human Rights, says, only Western culture turned widely shared propositions about human dignity and equality into a working doctrine of rights. The doctrine did not originate in Jeddah or Beijing, but in Amsterdam, Siena, and London. And it did not originate there either. It is rooted in the gospel revelation about the truth of the victim, which is the culmination of the whole biblical revelation. This syncretism that says it comes from everywhere misses something, and that is that this whole thing was put together by Eleanor Roosevelt. And her grandson is a personal friend of mine. And he tells me that when he was in college, he would come back to the Roosevelt estate late at night, 1 a.m, and there would be Eleanor, the only light in the house on, little pool of light, at her writing desk, answering correspondence, listening to Gregorian chant. He said she never took a breath that was not informed by her Christian faith. Where did this come from, this concern for the victim, which is expressed? It's this little thing. It seems nothing. And the Soviets say, oh, fine, let them have their rights organizations. And it brings the Soviet empire crashing down. What is this ferment that gets in and awakens our empathy for the victim and brings down sacrificial regimes of massive size and significance? I'm going to try to do something very quickly now, because what Ignatieff calls here innocuous syncretism that ignores the cultural specificity of this moral impulse has broader implications. I am encouraged by some remarks from yesterday to think that maybe postmodernism has already experienced its 15 minutes of ideological fame. I pray that that is the case, but you never know, so it lingers on some places. So I want to share with you something of a quite prophetic nature from a, you might think, unlikely source in my case, but a remarkable source, and that is to say Virginia Woolf. In a novel written in the 30s, 20s, I think, Virginia Woolf pictures a writer at the end of the novel. He's having dinner. He's wanted to be a writer all his life. He can hardly put two sentences together. And he's trying to account for his life at the end of his life. He's having dinner with an anonymous guest, and he's talking to this guest, and he says, now I must explain my life to you. In order to make you understand, to give you my life, I must tell you a story, and there are so many stories. Stories of childhood, stories of school, love, marriage, death, and so on, and none of them are true. And none of them are true. Yet, like children, we tell each other these stories, and to decorate them, we make up these ridiculous, flamboyant, beautiful phrases. How tired I am of these stories. How sick I am of these flamboyant phrases. That kind of weariness. He says, I have made up thousands of stories. I have filled innumerable notebooks with the phrases to be used when I have found the true story, the one story to which all the phrases refer, but I've never yet found that story. There must not be such a story, such a meta-narrative. His desk is littered with textual parts ready to be assimilated into the one true story, but he's never found the one true story, and therefore he can't make sense of his life, and he can't accomplish his literary aspirations. But leave it to Virginia Woolf. This is a question she poses at the end of the novel. She answers it in the middle of the novel, courageously. After this moment of complete indecision, he decides, well, I should travel. He goes to Rome. To Rome? You see, you wonder, is Virginia Woolf up to something here? He goes to Rome. You think, no, she couldn't be. But he gets to Rome, and he's behaving like a convalescent, he says, sitting there idly. And guess who comes strolling by? A group of Catholic priests. And he looks at these priests going by, and he says, in other times, people with my problem would have consulted them. But, he says, we resent teachers. Let a man get up and say, behold, this is the truth. And instantly I perceive a sandy cat filching a piece of fish in the background. Look, I say, you have forgotten the cat. One has to analyze this text very carefully. We resent teachers. This is the postmodern spirit in a nutshell. We resent teachers. Let a man get up and say, behold, this is the truth. And instantly I perceive a sandy cat filching a piece of fish in the background. Look, I say, you've forgotten the cat. Notice what Virginia Woolf is doing. She is showing us how arbitrary the objections are. She's perfectly capable of having Bernard assert an intellectual argument. He's perfectly capable of raising an issue about doctrine or about the shoddy history of the church or something that has a certain rationality to it. But she wants to make a point because she herself has been in these dialogues and she knows what drives them and she's honest about it. What drives them is resentment. We resent teachers. Let a man get up and say, behold, this is the truth. And we will seize anything, no matter how ridiculous, how arbitrary, we grab it and we throw it in the face of this universal claim, precisely because it's a universal claim. We say, you have forgotten the cat. The story you just told doesn't include the cat. Therefore, I don't have to deal with it. You see what I mean? This is the postmodern spirit par excellence. She's going to drive it home. In the middle of the novel, this same man is in boarding school. Much, much earlier, obviously, he's in boarding school with his other classmates. And it's a Christian boarding school, and the headmaster vests as a minister once a week and comes and preaches to them in the chapel. Puts a cross around his neck and stands up and reads the gospel and talks to them. Watch this. We resent teachers. Let a man get up and say, behold, this is the truth. And instantly I perceive a sandy cat filching a piece of fish in the background. Look, I say, you have forgotten the cat. So, this word, so, absolutely essential. So, Neville, at school, in the dim chapel, raged at the doctor's crucifix. So, raged at the doctor's crucifix. While I, who am always distracted, at once make up another story and thereby obliterate the angles of the crucifix. Please note what Virginia Woolf has done here. Note the relationship between the word truth and the word crucifix in this passage. It is not truth as such that is the problem ultimately. This is what Virginia Woolf is telling us and what postmodernists will not tell us. The postmodern allergy to truth, to meta-narrative, is a specific allergy to the Christian truth. It's another one of the sacred charades to decommission that truth, to sideline that truth. And it involves a kind of slaughter of literary innocence. All truth has to be sequestered in the interest of sequestering that one. And Virginia Woolf has laid it out as clearly as it can be laid out. And then Bernard later on says, I've never yet found the one true story. I've never yet found the one true story. There's more, but I think we should leave it at that so we can have a little time to talk about this. Thank you very much.
For more presentations by Gil Bailey and information about the Cornerstone Forum, please visit the Cornerstone Forum's website at www.cornerstone-forum.org. Thank you.